You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The United States is suspending its participation in bilateral channels with Russia that were established to sustain the cessation of hostilities. This is not a decision we took lightly.
With the Syrian ceasefire dead, bilateral cooperation over, and a landmark nuclear deal dumped, have US-Russia relations reached a new low? I'll have that debate with my guests Mary Dajewski and Phil Clark. Also ahead, why UK troops may be exempt from European human rights laws during combat, what's next with Turkey's crackdown following July's attempted coup, and does anyone really care about tonight's US vice presidential debate? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and Guardian, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, the University of London. Welcome to you both.
Evening.
Let's begin with Russia and its deteriorating relationship with the United States. Two developments this week have led some to say that America's ties with Russia have reached a new low, at least, of course, since the end of the Cold War. First, Moscow suspended a landmark nuclear agreement. Then just yesterday, the Obama administration announced it was suspending bilateral cooperation with Russia over Syria. Phil Clark, before we talk about why it matters, just how serious do you think this fracture is between the two nations?
It seems very serious, I think, and it would be difficult to imagine how the relationship could be patched up now, because clearly this is not just a division over what's happening in Syria, but the Russians have also brought in these historical issues around a nuclear deal and Ukraine and all manner of other issues. So to try and rebuild the relationship would mean having to deal with each of those specific matters. And the consequences of this, I think, are going to be felt quite desperately on the ground in Syria, where it does now look like Russia is going to continue with its sort of bombing campaign, that the US has lost any kind of leverage that it might have had there, and also over Assad via Russia. So it's a pretty dire situation, I would say.
Mary, let's leave aside Syria for the moment. What do you think the feeling is in Moscow about what it wants from a relationship with America? And I guess also a similar sort of question, what it thinks it can get right now from a relationship with America?
I sort of agree with a lot of what Phil says, but almost in a sort of mirror image way, in that I think maybe it's not quite as desperate as it looks, and that both in Moscow and Washington, there is a degree of playing to the home gallery, and that the element of the American election can't really be overestimated, because, I mean, I get the impression, you know, not just in Moscow, but in a lot of places around the world, basically international relations are on hold for the next month or so until they know what's going to happen. And this is it's a very unusual election, both because of the sort of distance and the characters of the two main contenders, and also because certainly nobody knows really what's going to happen. People think, you know, they look at the odds that it's going to be Hillary Clinton, but you can't actually rely on it. And I think that looks no different in Moscow than it does in almost any other capital. So that what, as it were, they've put on hold in terms of this nuclear agreement. What's interesting to me was that they didn't just suspend it. They also attach these conditions that Phil was talking about, And by attaching those conditions, they give, I think, quite a strong signal of what they're actually looking for in terms of policy outside Syria, that they may have given up on actually trying to settle anything bilaterally in Syria. But they are looking at other things. And the fact that they mention that and they set them out as conditions like sanctions on Ukraine and various other things, I think that suggests that they are looking at things a little bit more broadly.
And Phil, you know, in a sense, this happens at the end of any American president's second term, particularly when it's unclear as to whether that president's preferred nominee is going to take over from him, that they lose their influence. It's seeping away from them day by day.
Yeah, it's one of the tragedies of this conflict, I think, that one of the big players that has leverage on the ground is rendered almost powerless by the fact that he's caught in an end game of his own presidency. And as is always the case, it's civilians on the ground that are suffering as a result of this kind of political stasis at the top level. And it, I think, gives some pause for thought about the way that Western governments run these kind of elections. The fact that politics just kind of ceases to exist, and so especially in the case of the US, where so much time, energy and money is completely consumed by these campaigns, it means that actually some really serious policy issues are not dealt with as a result. I mean, you could argue that in fact this kind of inaction on Obama's part, at least on the foreign policy front, really has been going on now for 6 or 7 months. I mean, John Kerry's been running around, you know, trying to deal with Iran and trying to deal with Syria and all manner of issues, but I think everybody suspects that there's very little muscle from the president's office behind any of this. This has been going on for months now, and it's a monstrous problem.
I think the breakdown specifically in talks between Russia and the United States over Syria reflects something else too, that maybe for too long everybody has expected that if Russia and the United States get together and they hammer out a deal of whatever sort, that they can actually deliver on it like they could do, say, 20 years ago. And I think Syria maybe is the latest piece of evidence we have that's actually no longer so. They did a deal.
But arguably Russia could, though. I mean, I think you can make a case that America can't deliver on a deal because, you know, the rebels that wanted yes. American support will turn around and say, well, you weren't backing us anyway. We've been getting our arms from Qatar and others and so on.
Yep.
But the Syrian government really could be put under the put under the thumb by Vladimir Putin.
Well, I think that is in question too. And one of the things that struck me very much in the State Department statement that they put out announcing that they were breaking off talks over Syria was that they said, and this was almost the first time I'd seen them acknowledge this, that Russia either would not or could not control what was going on the ground in Syria. And there was a slight indication then that, at least from their point of view, they entertained the idea that maybe Assad was not under the control of Moscow to the extent that maybe they've assumed so far. And I tend to agree with them. I mean, I think it's not just
I'm not arguing that he's under control from Moscow. I'm arguing that Moscow has a lot of influence.
But does it have enough influence? That's the question. Do they have enough influence to get what, not just what Moscow might want, but what, you know, they did the deal with the United States on the ceasefire and the aid corridors and everything. Do they have sufficient influence to push that through? And I suspect that in the breakdown of that ceasefire, we have evidence that actually they can't.
Phil Clark, early on in George W. Bush's first term, he invited Vladimir Putin to the White House and said, I've looked into his eyes and I've seen his soul. That relationship then obviously deteriorated. When Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she pushed the reset button with Sergei Lavrov, and I think they even made a big reset button. I mean, quite why you had sort of, you know, two senior people from Russia and the US pressing a big red button together. I don't know, but still.
And they ruined it by translating reset wrongly.
But yes, exactly. I mean, it was doomed from the start. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, they can always try and start again once, you know, Hillary Clinton or even Donald Trump is elected president, you know, these two nations are quite likely to sort of feel each other out again, aren't they?
I think so. I mean, Trump couldn't have made any more praiseworthy comments about Putin if he'd tried. So there have certainly been these kind of diplomatic overtures from the US. But I still do wonder how much damage has been done in the events of the last week or two. And I recall, I think I spoke about this the last time I was on this program. I recall a piece by Mary's colleague at The Independent, Patrick Coburn, who actually saw that the agreement between US and Russia over the ceasefire in Aleppo as a really significant moment, not just on the ground, but also in terms of the relations between the two states. But he also, I think, warned in that piece that if that ceasefire fell apart and if relations between the US and Russia kind of fell apart as a result, it would be very, very difficult to put this back together. So I would like to share your optimism that this is maybe some sort of cosmetic fight that can be easily patched up. I suspect it might take a little bit longer than that.
I just want to very briefly get into Syria itself, because we've been sort of dancing around the edges of this. For the United States now, this is kind of it, isn't it? Because they've made it clear they're not going to get involved directly militarily. They have talked about funding rebels, training rebels, providing some weapons, and they've sort of dabbled a bit here and there over the last 5 years, but not really. It was, for them, it was diplomacy or nothing. They're not going to, you know, help set up a no-fly zone, are they?
No, I mean, there's not the slightest chance of that, both because I think it's been against President Obama's judgment pretty much the whole time, but also because he's got so little time left, and convention is that you don't do those sort of risky things right at the end of your presidency. So, no, that's not going to happen. But I think when you said, you know, for the Americans, basically, that this is it in terms of a role in Syria, I think that is absolutely right. And I think that in some ways this may explain the very sharp words that American spokespeople are using in relation to Russia, because there is a sense that if they weren't using that language, then more people would actually be pointing out that basically, you know, as you say, this is basically the end of America's diplomatic involvement, at least for the time being, in Syria.
This, in a sense, highlights, Phil, the enormous trouble that even a nation as powerful as America has in trying to influence events around the world when it's not prepared to take military action.
Indeed. When a state decides that it's not willing to put boots on the ground, that it's not willing to go in completely gung-ho. And I should also say, I think it's a good thing that the US is not willing to do that, because I think it would really blow this whole conflict completely sky high. It would complicate it enormously. But without that kind of willingness...
Some would argue with like almost 400,000 people dead, it's pretty sky high already.
Yes, true. It would be hard to escalate from this point onwards. But I think even the US's involvement in this region over the last decade would suggest it's much better on the sidelines than it is a fully fledged actor. But I think what this shows is that you really do have to make a choice, that there is kind of no middle ground in terms of involvement here. If you don't have serious allies inside the country, if you don't have very, very good intelligence, and if you have your own military very much on the back foot at the moment, you end up with the US in this kind of weakened position as it stands at the moment.
Okay, we'll move on. And we'll head to where we are right now, the UK, where government ministers here have announced that British soldiers could be protected from legal action under the European Court of Human Rights. In the past, the ECHR has attempted to extend its reach to the battlefield. Under this new plan, though, the UK would be exempted from those laws during the duration of a specific conflict. Phil, there's been a lot of talk in the UK over the last week or so in particular, but, you know, going on for some time about about British soldiers being accused of war crimes and how damn unfair it is.
Yes, and in fact, the UK is subject to an International Criminal Court investigation into crimes in Iraq, and there's potentially a new investigation into UK crimes in Afghanistan in the offing as well. I mean, I think this latest move by the UK government really is just nationalistic posturing, because the reality is UK soldiers are still subject to the Rome Statute of the ICC. They're still subject to the Geneva Conventions just like anybody else. And of course, they're also already subject to quite strict domestic law governing the behaviour of troops. So to a certain extent, you know, this is a little bit of a post-Brexit sort of smokescreen in many ways. But I think it is an important statement about the UK's belief that it is in many ways above the law. Mm. And it does try to separate the UK out from a whole set of standards that it believes other countries should be subject to, but that its own forces should not. So there's a massive dose of hypocrisy involved in this.
Sitting on the fence there, Phil. And Mary, you know,
well, I have to say that I agree with a lot of that, but I also have mixed feelings about it, because yes, it does say if you're going unilaterally to exempt British troops from these international requirements, then it does say that you are above everybody else and unimpeachable, and that the rules that apply to others shouldn't apply to you, and that's obviously, you know, that is not a good thing, and it sends a very bad message about the UK and what it sort of stands for. But at the same time, I think that the way those provisions have been used by some people in, especially in Iraq, with the encouragement of very activist lawyers in the UK to target particular detachments of troops with the expectation of what seems enormous compensation, regardless of the fact that what was going on was a battle and that this was a war. And this is where I slightly disagree, because I think that there has been that attempts have been made to capitalize on this, really for financial gain, because even a relatively modest settlement in UK terms is an enormous sum for Iraqis. And so I think that aspect of things has really gone too far.
But are we, in these cases, are we talking just, are you just concerned that it's too much money? Because actually, you know, when you hear some of the defenders of you know, military behaviour, and, you know, we should point out this is, you know, a few isolated cases, but they are cases nonetheless that appear to be real. We're talking about serious abuses of people, whereby, and it's often you hear people in the military saying, oh, well, you need to understand the stress these soldiers were under. Some of their friends had recently been killed. You need to understand how difficult the situation there was at the time. It's surely a nation like Britain is able to say, okay, if, you know, if we're accused of, our soldiers are accused of doing things wrong, let's find out what happened.
Yes, but I think there comes a point when things get, so they get taken to such lengths and so many people are involved, and you do have to, that there has to be some point at which you recognize that the country has been at war. You know, I opposed the intervention in Iraq, the intervention in Libya, the whole concept of rendition, and the way people were sort of transported from continent to continent, and torture was used by, you know, first world countries, which is really completely outrageous. And the paradox is that in those cases, almost none of the details have come to light, because everything has been shrouded in secrecy and under the cloak of national security. And yet cases which were sort of on the ground in Iraq have been subject to tribunals and subject to much more open consideration. And I think that to an extent, smaller cases have got the publicity and the money, and the bigger cases, the people have got off without any punishment whatsoever.
Phil?
I mean, I think if African governments acted the way that the UK has acted about these cases in the last couple of years, that they would be rightly held up for massive criticism. And there would be talk of the need for ICC intervention to hold criminals accountable for their actions during wartime. So I think there is a real double standard going on here. It's interesting, actually, because the UK's argument against the ICC investigating UK crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan is, look, don't worry, we're dealing with these cases domestically. Mm. And under the Rome Statute, that's fine. That's a totally reasonable legal argument. But there was a piece in The Guardian last week indicating just the lengths that David Cameron had gone to when he was prime minister to try and shut down the Iraq historical allegations team, which was the team inside the UK government solely mandated to try and investigate crimes committed by UK troops. We had the Baha Moussa case in 2003, the only example in which a UK soldier has been successfully convicted of war crimes committed in Iraq. But the judge in that case said that he was ashamed that he could only convict the smallest fish in that case, and he was not able to deal with the five senior commanders because they had closed ranks and basically had refused to give evidence. So what that suggests, I think, is that the UK is not actually very serious about holding its own troops accountable. The legal argument then would suggest that this may actually be prime material for some sort of external intervention by a body like the ICC.
And that's the thing, Mary, isn't it? Because when you look at the Baha Moussa case, it was, and you look back at what was said at the time by the Ministry of Defence. They were like, no, this is nonsense. There's no case to answer. It's vexatious. It's these money-grabbing lawyers. A lot of the language that we're hearing right now. And then it turned out that actually what had been alleged was true, was horrendous, had been done by British soldiers.
Yep. No, I agree. And I don't want to absolve British soldiers, but I think the extent to which things have run or sort of gone into very small scale things, that maybe it's been taken a bit too far. But I would also say that the UK finds itself in a rather betwixt and between situation, because it's the chief ally of the United States, as it was, especially in Iraq. And the US, of course, is not signed up to the International Criminal Court, and it automatically regards all its troops and commanders as it were, above international law, and it's made that absolutely clear that that was the reason why it wasn't signing up to it. So, you know, the British find themselves in this strange position of having signed up to that, having been signed up to the European Convention by virtue of not of being in the Council of Europe, not the European Union, and subject to those rules, and yet at the same time trying to get out of them, but behaving rather like Americans. So it's a very it's a very unsatisfactory situation.
Yes, we should have actually pointed out at the start the ECHR actually has nothing to do with the European Union, and Britain is still part of it. Although, frankly, who knows right now? We will move on. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking about Turkey and who's going to have the second best job in America. Second best, second worst, who knows?
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, here at Studio One with Phil Clark and Mary Dijewski. I told you we'd talk about Turkey. I'm afraid we're not going to. That'll be tomorrow night. Apologies. Instead, we're going to talk about the two vice presidential candidates in the US who are going head to head in their first and indeed only debate later on tonight. In Hillary Clinton's corner, Tim Kaine. In Donald Trump's, Mike Pence. Does anyone know who these guys are, though, Phil Clark? And does anyone really care? Does it matter, the vice presidential debate?
Mary and I were discussing this before we came on air and thought that these two men seem completely synonymous, that they kind of bleed into one another, that they seem kind of featureless in many ways, and their names suggest as much, Kaine and Pence. I'm not sure that I will stay up tonight to watch the debate, although I would be fascinated at least to see the contrast with Trump and Hillary and the frightening possibility that there might be less rancor and more substance. But yeah, that's not going to be enough to make me stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning to watch the big stoush between Kane and Pence.
I mean, the interesting thing here is, Mary, I mean, there's two interesting things. One is, depending on which way this election goes, either one of these men could feasibly be the presidential candidate in 4 years' time. But I guess the other thing as well
is worse than that, because either of them could actually be exactly that heartbeat away from the White House
indeed.
Vice President is, because we've got two of the oldest ever candidates for president.
There is that. The other thing I won't say is, in Mike Pence, you know, like him or loathe him, at least you will hear a true conservative Republican on stage tonight. And that will be something very different that we've heard during this campaign.
You've been missing them already.
What was that? I'm missing them. But, you know, it was striking, you know, watching Trump in the first debate. It's, if you're a conservative, you know, genuine, you know, conservative a la, you know, well, I was going to say, like Romney or McCain, they were never seen as true conservatives, but you know what I mean. You would not see actually much in Donald Trump that you would like.
No, that's, I mean, he's a maverick Republican, and that was one of the reasons why the Republican Party generally took so long and found it so difficult to sort of line up behind him. But I think that, you know, choosing your vice president, there's always this great question every 4 years, does it matter who the candidate chooses? And this year we've seen so little of the vice presidential candidates that you can argue reasonably, credibly, that actually it doesn't matter. But the way that especially Trump has tried, as it were, as they say, to balance his ticket with exactly this sort of very, very conventional classical Republican, it may just matter for him.
Okay. I want to ask in a moment whether the debate itself actually works. But first, I want to play a little clip. This is from the 1988 debate between Dan Quayle, who was the Republican vice presidential candidate, George H.W. Bush's number two, and Lloyd Bentsen, who was the VP candidate for the Democrats, who was number two to Michael Dukakis. This is a little bit of their clip. You'll hear Quayle first.
I have far more experience than many others that sought the office of vice president of this country. I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Bentsen.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Now, Phil Clark, that is one of the most memorable lines from any political debate, in not just in the US, in the world. And actually, you know, when we mentioned this beforehand, we could both quote most of it. Here's the thing, though. Dan Quayle, despite being made to look like an idiot, went on to win with George H.W. Bush by a landslide.
What does that tell us about the importance of these debates? I mean, again, maybe they're not that important at the end of the day, but I think it also guarantees that the two men that will debate tonight will still come out looking much better than Dan Quayle ever did. I think what's really interesting, I mean, I'm sort of fishing, I think, for an interesting angle on the Kane Pence fight, but I think I might be able
Thanks.
To I might be able to unearth one, and I think that it is interesting that in fact you have two very devout, Catholics. I mean, one is a sort of a lapsed Catholic now turned evangelical, whose views on the big moral issues, which we actually haven't heard a lot of in a US presidential debate for the first time in a long time, issues around abortion and gay marriage and the rest of it, actually probably see eye to eye. Kane's history on these issues suggests that he also is himself very, very conservative, is very conscious of the importance of the Catholic political lobby behind him. And so I don't think he's going to pick many fights with Pence on those kinds of issues. So the moderator undoubtedly will ask about those issues tonight because they haven't featured very heavily in the debates between Trump and Clinton. But I don't think the moderator is going to get much of a fight out of Pence and Kane on that.
And just finally and briefly, Mary, I guess one thing that will be interesting looking at is how Kane tries to paint Pence with the Trump brush, which is something that Democrats are going to be trying up and down the ticket throughout this campaign.
Yes, that will be very interesting to watch, as it will be to imagine the sort of dynamic between the two of them. But, you know, if you were advising him, you would say, well, actually, you don't have to, as it were, pretend to endorse Trump. You have to simply to put your own position as this classic Republican. And that possibly would be good enough.
Okay. We will maybe not watch tonight, but we'll catch the highlights tomorrow. That's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. Thank you to Mary and to Phil. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Khan. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Section D with Henry Rhys Sheridan is in half an hour. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.